still alive, so you're through the big event. We'll probably go around the room to start and introduce. We kind of know each other, but we'll start off that. So I'm Mark Bolt, County Council.
I'm Tim Cook. I'm from Clark College.
Laura Lebowski with Clark County Community Planning.
I'm Mary Elson. I'm with the Vancouver Neighborhood Alliance.
Mark Ross, Superintendent of Battleground School District.
Mike Strome, Superintendent with Washougal School District.
Sharon Cruz, Washington State Vancouver College of Education.
John Steech, Superintendent Evergreen.
Tyson Vogler, Superintendent Green Mountain School District.
Nathan McCann, the Ridgefield School District.
Vanessa Gaston, Director for Community Services, Clark County.
Andy Silver, Executive Director of the Council for the Homeless.
Kimberly Hunt, Superintendent of Educational Services District 112.
Krista Zuckel-Bentel, Chief of Staff, Clark County.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we'll take it away with school permitting issues. So we've talked about these come from our last agenda. So can you take it away?
Yeah, Lori Lebowski attended a meeting last week with the interested parties in this particular issue. So I'm going to ask Lori to walk you through what was discussed.
Okay. To direct your packet, there's probably the second page. Says Subcommittee on Permitting. That's just an outline of the issues that was discussed at the meeting. So the meeting was held last Friday. A lot of people who work in facilities for the school district, some superintendents. It was also the community development staff, the director, Marty Snell, people from the fire marshal's office, public health, people who work on permitting issues with the school district. So community development talked about their new initiatives, one including there's going to be a survey that they're going to send out to stakeholders, and we want to make sure that the school district people get copies of this survey to talk about their experience with the Permit Center. In 2 weeks, there's going to be a new manager of the Permit Center here. They're also going to be evaluating the Permit Center's processes. So Marty just discussed that. Community development also formed an internal review group. People from all the different sub-departments within community development, including the permit center, planner, someone from development engineering, and they're going to meet on a regular basis, and they're going to focus on school permitting issues. We did have a round table and just talked about issues in the past with getting permits. The schools talked about your funding process and how that works for constructing schools or installing modulars and portables, and the difference between modulars and portables, which I didn't really know. We talked a lot about permitting the review, streamlining the review process for the portables and modulars, and talked about communication over timelines. We had a big discussion about public health, and I think there's a concern that there needs to be a parallel process with public health. So I know that schools are on tight timelines when school starts. We want to be able, at the beginning of the school year, to have the facilities ready. And so part of accomplishing that goal is to maybe have some parallel review processes in place, including public health, also stormwater. Talked about the challenges with stormwater. We have state requirements with that, so that's going to be a challenge. And finally, we talked about more big picture policy issues with schools in terms of development review code, in terms of land for schools, in terms of integrating schools with long-term transportation plans. And that's going to be a future discussion item with another subcommittee where we just talk about big policy issues and development code issues. And that's all I have.
And is that group going to continue to meet to address these issues?
I think they'll meet on an ad hoc basis, especially in terms of a docket item. So we have a docket process. Under state law, we can open up our comprehensive plan once a year, and that window is passed. But we've made it a docket, probably be a docket item next year. So we might have some ad hoc meetings to discuss that docket item. list of issues that we all discussed at our first meeting, and I know the number one issue was the permitting process. So I believe that we've had this meeting, and we're going to have some follow-up items, so this first list or first item is addressed.
I don't see Marty here.
Yeah, he had a conflict.
What? Oh, you did?
Yep.
So was there talk about the schools, I don't think it's called the schools committee.
A work group.
Yes.
A dedicated team.
Yeah,
I think there's been some discussion of that.
Yeah, there's a team put together, and actually people that are on that team attended that meeting on Friday, so people from the school districts could meet people on that team.
Okay.
And we handed out a list of the names and their contact information, and Vicki Kirscher is going to be the project manager for that team, and she'll coordinate those meetings.
Okay. And is that, I know when we did, I was familiar with it, of course, but when we did Hawkinson, the dates weren't as forceful to the county as they probably could have been. So, I mean, you have dates that can't, it has to be met. So I think is that a good communication now that we know them dates?
We talked about in the meeting having what we call the school season.
Yeah.
Where the schools, people from the school district contact community development, say this is our window when we're going to need our permits. So that was discussed.
I think that I brought up the possibility, distinct possibility, with either current projects, either just wrapping up, underway in Ridgefield, underway in Hawkinson, will be underway in Vancouver, as well as what may be potential in a couple of other school districts if they run and bonds and are successful, that it's not out of the realm of estimation that we'd be around $2 billion of projects in the county here over the coming years. And that I was pleased, as I'm looking at the committee notes here, that there is a consideration of a school permitting internal review team. To the degree that that team can meet early or more frequently as needed with respective school district members to have a better understanding of what's taking place in that school district and what a prospective timeline would look like, I think the better off we will be. I was probably in my comments more specific to the GCCM process, general construction management process that, you know, for example, Washougal utilized, one of the first ones in the area, and I know other school districts are in the process of looking at it. And there are advantages to that, but I think there would be advantages to the county being at the table with school districts, with our construction management team that we hire, as well as our contractor and our architect, so that there is, it doesn't mean that they have to be at the table at every meeting, but that they would be at the table as necessary, whether that's monthly or every other month, to truly have an understanding of, back to your point, Mark, the timeline that the school district is pressing on and why they're making the decisions that they're making in that timeline.
Yeah.
So that there is no surprise at the end here relative to, first of all, obtaining the permit. So the earlier the involvement there is on the schematic design end of it, and then through some of the other comprehensive design, the better off we are going to be on the tail end of the project when it comes to, or throughout the inspection phases, and of which I know varying districts have had some challenges through that process. So, but it was good to hear also from the team that there are some changes within the permitting and also the inspection department. So I think we're on the same page. But the proof is in our ability to stay connected to each other on those topics. I don't know, John, does that summarize that particular topic? I know you were there. If I I may, I'm going to talk a little bit about portables. I'm going to provide some context to that. So when we talked about portables the other day, we were specific to the K-3 funding that comes through the state and obligations districts have to meet in order to apply for the K-3 grants for school construction. And one of those, as we learned when we and a number of other districts went through an audit, was that they'll come down and they'll audit your building and they're going to take a look at every bit of square footage that you have, whether or not it's a portable or a modular or what we call brick and mortar. Well, as we learned, well, what do you mean there's the difference between a modular and a portable? And a modular, by their definition, is a building with footings and a foundation, and it's, they view that as a more permanent structure. We would view that as something that we put in temporarily, but we were required to put in like that by the county with footings. And given that, it counts against us. So if we were to back that out as just a portable that had pedestals, they see that truly as something that is portable and we can move. But if we have it with footings and foundation, they say, no, that's a permanent structure that counts against you. We cannot then apply where that square footage counts against you in terms of your ability to get additional classrooms through the grant. Okay. Well, that's pretty significant.
Yeah.
If schools throughout the county for years have been asked to build a certain way, particularly with K-3 classrooms. So, Todd, you might want to, did I summarize that?
Yeah.
Okay. And we need to, I think we need to visit that because that could come back to bite districts here for years to come if we can't find some middle ground there that ultimately helps us, assuming these grants and funding from the state remain available.
Is that strictly a county code or is that a state code that the county adopted? Do you have any?
Todd, you'd be able to.
It's probably a combination of building code and county requirement for what level of foundations or footings are necessary for portable structures. And it's been increasing over the years to add more concrete permanent foundations like under portables to the point where, as Mike said, they're now defining them as modulars, which is a more fixed piece of construction. The original intent of portables were they could be moved. They're properly anchored to the ground, but not with permanent foundations to that expense.
I think it's going to depend on the structure and the state building requirements and then what they're proposing to do, if it's one portable or if it's a group of 5 or 10 portables. If you have a group of 5 or 10, then that's a whole different issue.
Oh, then I think, like, Battleground, they've gone into modular intentionally with longer-term structure as a longer-term solution, which has foundations, right? Do they have footings?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's defining our own, how do we define them locally?
Right.
The difference between the two would be helpful.
So then can we, I'll work on this too, but maybe we should make sure where our county code is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
If it's coming from state building code, then we got to start talking to the state because both people are talking amongst themselves. It don't make any sense if it's state building code.
Yeah, I think it's interpretation because we can run the same plan through the city and they'll have a different requirement for how to do this, the footings or support. So I think there is certain guidance at the state building level, building code, but it's also a local interpretation of that code. It might be good to get the city involved, too, to see how, at least City of Vancouver, right? And the other cities may be viewing them differently as well.
Yeah.
If there could be some uniformity of this, so Ridgefield put in 11 last year and 7 more this summer that we're just finishing up. And we've talked with the folks from Pacific Mobile about this. The rigidness of the process down here has So we had a real, we chose the path of least resistance this year. But last year we tried to battle, and they came in last year at a little over $300,000 for 1,800 square foot portable, modular, the
two
way
classrooms.
Anchored, yeah. Two classrooms. I did count the furnishings inside, but that's a pretty expensive temporary solution. And when the permitting process and the requirements around that account for an awful lot, there's an awful, I made the joke that if there was inclement weather, that was complete. I was going to go hunker down. That was safer than some of our bricks and mortar, in my opinion. Certainly, it was seismically probably more ready to withstand than some of our older buildings would be. And so that's just something to think about. It's got real economic implications, too, for each of the school districts. And if there could be some consistency throughout the county, certainly, I think school districts would welcome that.
Yeah, I think an important point to that was brought up at the table as well is that, and Todd, you may have raised this, is that these are LNI
state certified
portable structures. So, to the degree that we are layering another requirement on there or others, it may be overkill. I mean, obviously, you're talking to superintendents here. We want safe buildings.
Yeah.
But to the degree that we have something that's safe, the letter of the law, but also gives us flexibility to timing-wise to get them in with a little more, so that gets back to the timeliness in terms of when you have to start the permitting to do that, to get that building in there, and how quickly it takes to get it in there. And then long-term, is it something that if we own it, how quickly can we re-site it if we had to move it elsewhere on the property or in the school district? Because I know given growth in certain communities, you may say, well, this is the best place we can put it here, and then, we passed a bond. We passed a bond to build in certain areas, but we can still use this in another place. It's just a heck of a lot harder to move that, quote, modular than it would be a portable off of a pedestal. So
I'm curious whether this might be an appropriate topic for another meeting of that same subgroup, maybe a couple weeks from now, so that this particular issue can be addressed. Is that a good way to move forward, or is there another, or would you prefer us to do some research and get back to the group as a whole?
I think we've got a couple things here that that we talked about the other day that it's, you know, it's either you spread your time out over half a dozen items or we nail down a couple and say we can solve these and get these as early wins relative to our collaborative efforts, and portables is one of them. And we understand what the code requirements are at the state level, city, county, and where we might find some common ground and meet everybody's needs. I think the sooner we could do that, great. I think to the degree that we look at the bigger item that I talked about around the county, their team also sitting at the table, or inspectors or planners sitting at the table in early schematic design, that's something we probably should keep at the forefront, because I really do think it would build a greater level of understanding of what a school district's trying to accomplish with a couple of projects that would save time on the back end in terms of meeting timelines and being able to move into a building on time.
I would suggest that have the internal review team, because they are all the community development staff and they have the expertise to discuss these issues, maybe convene a meeting with them and the school district staff. And I can follow up on that.
Would that meet your needs for follow up? Because I agree that we should be discussing this soon.
I think so. I don't want to speak for everybody.
Resolution.
We're on the tail end, but I think there are a lot of folks that are midstream, and it isn't to say that 2 years from now I wouldn't be back here talking about portables myself again.
Yeah.
Does that internal review team include the cities?
It does not right now. Right now it's basically the community development staff and the school districts, but if you want the cities.
I would request one of the keys is that we figure this out with all the cities.
Okay.
For consistency.
Yeah,
all right.
That would be a big.
Okay.
Because when you buy, no one knows what to do when you're buying these.
So
the rest of our agenda today is a is basically information sharing. There were topics that you voted on when we met last.
Okay.
Go ahead. I apologize.
Sorry, but Alan. So I think just as important. So because you talked about the health requirements.
I'm looking at it.
And it's kind of what you're looking at.
Yeah, it's WAC 246.
Probably the question then is, I think also is that how do you work with the other cities when you're trying to figure them out too? Because you're in their shop, I would think, on these schools.
Yeah, so I have Joe Laxon here. I don't know if you want to mention anything, but we talked about, you had mentioned a technical advisory committee, which would include representatives of the schools as well as the city. So that's one thing we're looking at to get input. And I don't know if that relates to what you're talking about, Laurie, but maybe we're talking about the same thing. That we would work to develop a technical advisory committee that would include all those entities. And we'd include 246-366 in there. So.
Right. Yeah, we talked about it on Friday, and Joe was at the meeting, and we would include public health in that review team.
You ready? Okay. Thank you. So the rest of our agenda is actually going to be an overview that touches on the issue of the services that are available that the county provides with respect to youth coping skills, mental health, and homelessness, poverty, health, et cetera. So first, Vanessa and Andy will give an overview. Vanessa and Andy Silver with the Council for the Homeless will give an overview of current resources available for families and students addressing youth coping skills and supporting student success.
Good afternoon. I'd want to introduce, I asked for some representatives, and I'll explain kind of a little bit about kind of the change here, but if you guys can introduce yourself and your title, they're also here to help answer some questions.
Hi, I'm Christine Kaffer with Community Health Plan in Washington, and Michelle, I'm a health specialist.
Hi, I'm Cindy Wolverton, and I'm the Southwest Regional Manager for Healthcare Services with Molina Healthcare.
And I'm Judy Hoyen, and I'm a case manager with Molina Healthcare and Child Mental Specialist. We work when we had the RSM 14 years there as well as a care manager.
Okay, I'm Samantha, the Vice President of Clinical Integration for the Southwest Washington Accountable Community College, which is the nonprofit agency that has been set up to implement the Medicaid demonstration lab project in Clark's Media and Clark's Accounts.
Thank you. Thank you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go over the behavioral health slides and see if they want to chime in, and then Andy will handle the conversations and issues around homelessness. So first, before I get into this, make sure I get this right. So when I say the word behavioral health, we are talking about mental health and kids who are also addicted to drugs and alcohol. If you want specific information about children who have intellectual disabilities, who have Down syndrome, brain injuries, autism, that's a whole different conversation, and we can bring back the staff and the contractors. There's quite a few of them that work with the children. But today, specifically, talking about mental health, kids who are diagnosed with mental health or suspected to have mental health issues or drug and alcohol issues. Back in April of 2016, Clark County and Skamania County, we are a region. We're Southwest Washington region. We are what we consider early adopters for integrating the Medicaid programs for medical, mental health, and substance abuse. So we were first in the state to go, which basically meant our regional support network went away. And then also the county managed the chemical dependency contracts for outpatient. That also ended. And what happened was, we have two health plans that was done through a competitive process. So we have Community Health Plan of Washington and Molina Healthcare, who now do all of that into that Medicaid program for those three programs, medical, mental health, and substance abuse, for the Medicaid population. So children that are low income on medical, Apple Health Medicaid, if you think about that program. For kids that, for strictly for behavioral health, who are low income, uninsured, could be some of your undocumented children, that is going to be Beacon Health Options. Danny, I know you don't work for them anymore, but if you could chime in a little bit.
I think they spent 15 months working for them, aspects of what we call the non-Medicaid population. We get dollars from various sources, primarily from the state and federal grants, and create sort of a braided funding partnership model to support individuals who do not currently have health insurance. And a lot of that would include individuals without legal status to have health insurance through Medicaid, Washington, or private.
And so your first line, thank you, Daniel. So
I would just add one thing. It also supports kids, which I think is important. Kids who do not want to tell their parents that they are seeking services for treatment, because those are individuals that we also want to be able to access. So kids, through those programs and those dollars, can receive treatment for substance abuse and mental health without having to tell their parents, in accordance with Washington State law.
Thank you, Dan. So the first slide is really from Beacon Health Options, and the director for our region is Ina Liu. She couldn't be here today, but she wanted to basically kind of tell you they operate from a lot of federal grants. They also have some state-only dollars, and Daniel did a good job of trying to explain it. But what we were trying to do is target what are they doing right now for the schools. And so right now their SAP, which is the Substance Abuse Block Grant dollars, that is the largest block grant they operate. I think that's over close to $2
million. About $1.6 million.
And right now, they do support early intervention and prevention services offered by ESD 112, and they are in the La Center, Ridgefield, Hawkinson, and Evergreen school districts. They're willing to go anywhere, but school districts do have to make some space into their room. There's HIPAA that has to be compliant, and they do work with licensed treatment providers. ESD 112, they do partner with them, so they'll do some contracts that way as well. They also get the dedicated marijuana account funds. And so they do a lot of support the community-based intervention services, and that is provided by Community Services Northwest. They are in the Flex and 49th Street Academy. And again, all of their programs that they operate are evidence-based, and they are trying to, they do collect data on the children. There's the reports that have to go up to the states. So they are trying to do what they can to try to do with their support. That particular source of funding. Again, it is geared towards children that are uninsured, low income, or do, like he said, do not want to tell their parents any insurance. So I just wanted to mention that. The next slide is really geared towards your Medicaid, children that are on Apple Health Medicaid. And let me just kind of go over these slides and I'm going to ask you guys to chime in a little bit. So basically what we were trying to do is just kind of gather what's currently happening right now. Catholic Community Services, they work with both Beacon and the Medicaid health plans, Molina and Community Health Plan of Washington. But one of the things I want to share with you that's going to start on September 1st, which we've never had in our community before, and it's for the entire region, is to have a mobile youth outreach team that can go out and see kids with mental health and drug and alcohol issues. This will be mobile. They're going to be reaching out to each of the school districts, if they haven't already, to sign some MOUs. To kind of determine kind of what that looks like. This is a new service for us. So these will be licensed clinical staff that will have some peers involved in it as well. We're excited about it because we have not had such a team for the youth and families before. So that will start up in September 1st. They also, there was a lawsuit that happened some attorneys representing some children, vulnerable children, sued DSHS. And there was a new program called the WISE, and Julie Speed knows quite a bit about that. But they also operate that WISE program for Southwest Washington, and children usually have to be in chronic situations, and I'll have Julie touch on it in a little bit. But so if you have children who have really severe kinds of conditions, mental health disorders, Catholic is the program that's going to do it. They try to keep the kids out of institutions. That's our goal, is that we don't want children to be institutionalized. So our goal is to try to work with the families and do some intensive wraparound services, PAC teams, which are your clinical teams that go out into the community. These are licensed clinical staff that are available. The rest of the providers up there, I'm not going to read them all to you, is just listing who is in the schools or who does community-based for the families. And it also, if they're in the school, they list which school districts they are in. And again, they're more than willing to kind of work with you to kind of, you want them in your school districts. Again, they do have to follow HIPAA. They do work with the health plans. Health plans pay for many of the services for the children on Apple Health Medicaid. So they're going to be limited in what kind of data they can share because of that confidentiality around that. Community Services Northwest, we actually fund them specifically for some substance use disorder. So they do bill Medicaid, but we also help pay for some outreach and stuff in the schools, and they're always looking to expand. So, again, they're in 15 different schools across the district or the counties, so they're also specifically targeting kids with drug and alcohol issues as well as mental health. Daybreak, I want to specifically talk to you about them. And if you haven't heard about Daybreak, they have just opened up a really wonderful facility to keep the kids in our community. So they do detox for youth. They also do an evaluation and treatment center for youth. So if kids actually have to be detained against their will for a period of time. They do residential, so kids that actually need to have more of an inpatient setting. They also do some outreach, and they also can do some limited outpatient. But pretty much they have the residential in our community. They just started it. It is a statewide facility, so they do work with other counties, but their goal is hopefully to prioritize Southwest Washington and the school districts here. So I just wanted to highlight that piece there. And then again, this is just another list of the different kinds of programs that are available in our community. I want to bring it to your attention again, NAMI. So they do some work around some youth peer mentoring training. They're going to be working with the Gila and the Evergreen School District. Again, so they're also offering, willing to kind of work and to expand their role as well. There are also some work around some suicide prevention and outreach around there too, working with Consumer Voices Are Born, works kind of a lot with adults, but NAMI also works with a lot of the families. And then I'm going to kind of ask if you guys want to chime in if any work you guys are doing around the suicide piece, and maybe Daniel, we could talk about the work that the Ottawa Community Health is doing around the larger health in the community. So Daniel, I'll start with you.
I'll try to frame it sort of at a 30,000-foot level, but the Southwest Washington Accountable Community Health, which I'll refer to as SWACH, has really been given an opportunity through the Medicaid demonstration waiver that we are in year one of a five-year program to essentially transform the way that services are delivered, transform the way that services are paid for, and integrates both physical health and behavioral health, which is a monumental task, as you could possibly imagine. But I think in our community right now, we have a tremendous amount of momentum. We have all of the players who are providing Medicaid services involved at the table. We are on the process for the end of the year to really develop our project planning. We also have a lot of the agencies that are your traditional agencies that support a wide variety of social determinants of health, so housing, all of the different things that you can imagine related to individuals who are in multi-system experiences in our community. We potentially could leverage up to, and I say this with a big asterisk because this would be meaning that we get 100% on all of our tests, $55 million into the region to do the things that we're charged with doing, which is transforming the way care is delivered, transforming the way care is paid for, and also to achieve the outcomes between physical health and primary care, so that any individual who walks into any primary care setting or any physical health setting or behavioral health setting, as well as any other door that they access health care, will have access to behavioral health services as well as physical health services that day or the next day. That's one of our goals. We welcome all the opportunities to work with the schools. I think we are in a position as the ACH to convene all parties to the table. So right now we are currently focused on the Medicaid population, but we know that our work will include the entire community. So more to come on how to strategize and to work with all the districts. I know we are reaching out in different capacities, and certain school districts have been at our table and are involved in our planning councils, our leadership councils, as well as our committee structure and our governance structure. Folks in this room very well could be aware of a lot of the work that we're doing, but I think in the next 6 months, you'll be hearing a lot more from us in terms of how we intend to convene and strategize around the entire region so that
what's happening in the community is there is a crisis collaborative committee that is looking at how do we improve our crisis system for mental health and drug and alcohol to be more early intervention and stop waiting till kids end up in the emergency room or adults. And so they're just about to start a youth crisis collaborative where Beacon and Catholic Community Services is a part of, and they'll be inviting different stakeholders. So if you're not already having a representative from the school districts, you probably will be invited to participate in that. And that's all about system design and system improvement to try to focus on, at the same time, we want to catch kids early, we want to work with families, we want to get people into treatment, and we want to keep them in our community and not institutionalized. You know, that should be the last resort, is having kids institutionalized. So I also want to make sure and mention that that's also going on. I think they're going to have their first meeting in September, I believe. But, I'm going to go over some programs that my department, the county, actually funds. So first off, the AWARE federal grant is not part of community services. Actually, this was the old slide, Lori. So.
Okay.
So, but I just want to make this clear. So the AWARE federal grant is something that Battleground School District operates. So they get that directly. So that's not part of community services. But the other programs on this list is actually some programs that we do operate. We either work with our staff and work with the youth themselves, or we work with nonprofit organizations to do these. And these are available to the community as well as available to the school district. So again, the Teen Talk program is a peer-to-peer. This actually spun out of probably about 15, Julie, how long was it when we got that federal system of care grant? How long?
2001.
So this came from the community, and this was because of some youth suicides at the time. And one of the things that came out was they felt there needed to be a peer-to-peer kind of program that teens could talk to and relate to. And so this is something that we kept going. They do a lot of stuff through social media as well as on the telephone. They are directly connected and trained with also partnering with the crisis line and 911. So they do not handle when calls get a little bit serious. They know how to pass that on. But I do want you to be aware that we try to market that across the school districts and in any of the youth programs. Okay, I'll tell you what happened. Oh, okay. And then again, we also are willing to kind of work with schools on doing the youth mental health first aid and challenge day. I think we have been in many of the school districts with challenge day. We do have a certified trainer who can do the youth mental health first aid, working with families, but also it's geared towards youth. I do believe we have one for adults. Do we have somebody trained to do adult mental health first aid?
Yes, throughout the region, yeah.
But this one is specifically, and it's Chris Henderson, if she specifically can do these for particularly for youth. Again, for Challenge Day, if you, and this is more specifically focused on anti-bullying, but it is to help address the schools and culture and working directly with teachers, administrators, and the youth. We also have our prevention program, which is part of a peer education, and we've targeted like marijuana. We work with the city council on policies, working with if you go into grocery stores or into corner markets around, you know, trying not to market marijuana to the children, you know, but they also do activities for youth to try to encourage them not to actually use. Dee Dee Seeler is the behavioral health manager. I don't know if any of you have met her, but she is available to come meet with any of you or to kind of talk about any of the different programs. She's also part of the crisis collaborative that's in the community. So I just wanted to make sure that you were aware that those particular programs, what we fund, are available to the community, and we're more than willing to kind of work with any school district, work with any nonprofits, and we're also partnering with the health plans and the Accountable Community Health around some things. The other thing we are looking at, one of the Accountable Community Health is around opiate addiction. So they have a kind of a responsibility to tackle opiate addiction in our community. So our staff have joined that work group, so we'll be looking at a region-wide strategy of what can we do, just like we did with meth, what can we do around the opiate addiction. So I know, has that group started?
Yeah, that group got started this summer, and really it's building off of a lot of different task force, and there's also statewide, so it's just a matter of aligning in this region, the statewide task force, some regional and local task force, and then putting those all together. That group is meeting, and we'll be able to leverage some, not only some best practices as it relates to
I would probably say I'm probably not the best one. Dee Dee could probably help you do that, and because I know she's worked with a number of the different schools, and specifically I don't know the logistics of it, but I would definitely contact Dee Dee and how that's done. Because we definitely would like to be in more schools.
Yes,
so.
Exactly. And I don't find
yeah. Anything else you guys want to add before we go to the homeless?
I would just, one thing I would add is you guys have heard the term WISE program. One thing that was required out of the WISE program is a governance structure that is overseen by youth. And so there's a group called, you might have heard of FISPRT, Family Youth System Partner Roundtable. They meet every month, and they have a direct charge from the state of Washington to provide input from those who use services in this region as well as families in this region. And then that direct line goes to the executive leadership team in the state of Washington with plaintiff oversight. So it's a wonderful venue for families to share their experience, to identify gaps in service, and to have a direct link from actually folks who are involved in services. So there's free food, there's free daycare, there's $20 gift certificates for kids to show up. We talked with a lot of juvenile probation folks. Anybody who is a youth or a family involved in any kind of services, past or present, really a great venue. We get 30 or 40 folks usually every month. A lot of stuff has come out of that. There's also some in the last 2 months. I think it's in Vancouver School District. There's been an entryway into it to have a local chapter within a school building. So I know there's been some push, some work around the state, specifically in the Tri-County area, where that's been a real effective model of not having the kids and the youth and families having to come to a meeting. Instead, we go and use your buildings, and it creates a real sense of community and ownership. And I think, in fact, 2 years ago, this group sat in front of this building and advocated for a particular law that was eventually, they learned how to advocate, it was eventually turned into law.
Thanks.
I'll leave my card here as well if folks want to reach out. I'm happy to provide more information.
All right, I'm going to hand it over to Andy. And I apologize, there was a handout with lots of community resources that we'll get to you. I didn't make a copy of them.
Thank you. Yeah, so I'm going to go over some programs that are available. Don't worry about needing to jot down notes because we'll just email out that handout and I'll have all the contact information on it. So before I begin, I want to provide some context for this part of the conversation. That was the right one.
Yeah, that PowerPoint that was up there was the right one.
Okay.
One challenge that we have in the homeless service world is that the definition of homelessness that is used throughout the school districts, which is federally mandated, McKinney-Vento, does not match the federally mandated definition that we use in the homeless service system. Sounds ridiculous? True. So the school definition is much more expansive. The definition used by schools includes families and children who are what we call doubled up and couch surfing, which certainly feels like homelessness to a lot of our families. It also, the way that the school definition works, if you're, once you go on that homeless list, you remain so till the end of that school year. In our world, the doubled up and couch surfing population is considered more at risk of homelessness. So you have to be outside in a car, in an emergency shelter, in some place without running water, electricity, that sort of thing to qualify. And it's at the time that you're looking for assistance or potentially going into a program that you have to meet the definition. So if you were homeless last week, but now you're doubled up with friends or family, you can't qualify for a lot of the programs in our system. So that's a big piece of context because it does create some barriers that we have to overcome while we're working together. Another enormous barrier is just the current situation in our community and the level of need when it comes to affordable housing and homelessness and the level of resources. In 2016, only 18% of people who were homeless, who were actively trying to get assistance to get back into housing, so they came to us, we knew exactly what they needed, only 18% we were able to actually serve community-wide because the programs are all full. So I'm going to talk about what programs are available, but that doesn't mean that if you have a family today that's in one of your schools and they're homeless, they can get into that program because they're waiting lists often for pretty much everything I'm going to talk about. And then the only good news on this list is that in response to some of these challenges, there are some resources and programs that have been targeted specifically towards K through 12 schools and the family and the children who attend them. So I'll talk about those first. I'll also talk about programs that are open to everyone in the community and, of course, to students in your school systems as well. So in terms of those targeted programs, the Vancouver Housing Authority a couple of years ago went through a community process with partners, the Healthy Living Collaborative and others, and sort of reprioritized how to get the biggest bang for their buck with their rental assistance. And one of their main focus right now is on helping children who are homeless by the school definition somewhere in Clark County in one of the school districts. So in implementing that, they've done a couple things. They created what's called the Student Housing Stability Program, which is a temporary rental assistance program. It's a two and a half year program that's currently working with Vancouver and Evergreen school districts. But if you're not in one of those school districts, I would encourage you to talk to the Housing Authority about potential expansion. And that program targets chronic absenteeism. Children come in who they're struggling both with homelessness and with absenteeism, and there are some workforce elements to the program, and there's sort of wraparound services in some of the community resource centers in those school districts as well. Another big service that the Housing Authority is providing, their main rental assistance program, Section 8 vouchers or housing choice vouchers, they have a preference. They have two preferences. So people who get in have to meet one of these two categories, and one of them is homeless by the school definition in a K through 12 school in Clark County. And again, I think they're in that program, they're working, if not with all of the school districts, with almost all. So if you're in a school district and you're not sure, I would encourage you to reach out to the Housing Authority. But that gives sort of a more narrow access to what is the best resource in terms of what's available, the amount that's available in the community, those Section 8 vouchers. Unfortunately, right now, due to federal cuts, the wait list for that program is open, but the Housing Authority isn't currently selecting families off of the wait list, and that, depending on where the federal budget goes, that might last another year or so. The Housing Authority also provides move-in assistance for families who have one of those Section 8 vouchers and are homeless. So if they don't have any income, for example, so how are they going to pay application fees, security deposits? There is some limited funding for that. And just recently, the Housing Authority began working with the Council for the Homeless, and because they have this time frame where they're not going to be able to place families off the wait list, what we decided to do was reach out to those families that are waiting and provide them with coaching and referral services to try to problem solve with them and see if there are any other resources in the community that might help them and or anything else they might be eligible for. So it's still worth it for families to get on that waiting list because eventually it'll open back up again. And even in the meantime, they might be able to get some extra sort of attention and coaching with the housing market. The two other types of programs that are specific to this population, one is a new statewide program. not this last legislative session, but the session before, there was something called the Homeless Student Stability Act passed. It had two parts to it. One provided more direct assistance to school districts and to hire liaisons and things like that. And then the other part was a competitive grant program for partnerships between school districts and homeless service providers to actually help families get back into housing. Last year, we were lucky enough, there was $1 million statewide and a partnership between Evergreen, Battleground, and Vancouver, and the Council for the Homeless was able to get $500,000 out of that $1 million pot. This year, we were able to keep the program going. They gave us $270,000. It's not quite as big, but it is that it's new money into the community directly helping those children in your schools. And the last one is an example of some school foundations' creativity, and that is the Vancouver Public School Foundation has what they call the 25% program, where they've partnered with the Council for the Homeless, and if there are families in that school district who are behind in their rent and need to catch up, they can pay it going forward, they just need to catch up, they'll pay up to 25% to get them there if they can come up with the rest of the money. So a way that the foundation is providing extra resources for their kids, but not having to deal with, you know, all of the things that go with that, like determining eligibility and talking to landlords, and we do that for them. And then sort of just more of the general landscape and things that are open to everybody. The way that our crisis response system is set up for homelessness, we have a sort of one-stop access point for the whole county. That's run through the Council for the Homeless Housing Solutions Center and our housing hotline. So it's not that we are providing all of the emergency shelter and housing programs in the county. It's that all of those different entities have come together and said, we want easy access, we want one eligibility determination for all of our programs. So families get referred to us, we do a screening, we figure out what they need, and then those programs let us know when they have an opening and we make the connection. Along with that, we've started, because it's one system for everybody and we only have one physical office, and that office is in central Vancouver, we realize that that's very hard for a lot of families throughout the county. So we are now once a week at the North Clark County Food Bank, trying to provide better access to North County, and we're once a week in Camas to try to provide better access to East County. And we can also do remote assessments too and screenings over the phone for families that can't make it to us. There are also just programs that are sort of part of the wraparound services that a lot of families who are homeless might need, but that also serve the community. A great example is the Community Housing Resource Center and work they do around helping families figure out how to budget, do debt settlement, which is a huge barrier in the rental market these days. If you have past debt to a landlord, you're not renting an apartment in Clark County until that gets paid off, or at least you're on a payment plan. So, again, I'll be following up with a list of these programs that touch on the different areas and which school districts it applies to and contact information. But hopefully this gives at least some ideas of the tough landscape that's out there, that people, especially the Housing Authority, are trying to provide extra resources and people you can reach out to if your district is interested in trying to create some of those partnerships.
That's our presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. And so we're going to move on to Dr. Alan Melnick and a brief overview of adverse childhood experiences and the work that public health is doing in that. Should we take a 5-minute break while we do that?
Except twice, they get to harass you.
open today. Yes.
So I also work. So we had probably 500 people on the quad for the eclipse. We handed out moon pies and viewing glasses. You know, pipe music and it was really cool. It was very cool. It was a great party. I talked to a couple people after. So she was every year. As of as far as I can tell, nobody's called me. I think everybody's shown up to their classes to teach them. I think, I think we're having a good day.
Probably is.
Yeah, and then we'll come back and join us tomorrow. About that. Last year was around, I was thinking about when graduation is like on the 9th and the 10th. Graduation is almost always commencement. It's like Mother's Day weekend. And so we're out whatever that week is before. So I was, it is nice. It is nice. You immediately go to the summer session because teachers go to school in the summer. We are almost the last week. We'll be still the end of July. But it's a way back. I'm flying to Spokane and driving to Poland on Wednesday for 2 days of meetings, so it makes you feel any better. We all start the same. Yeah. Washington State is all on the 10 calendar. Well, they were calling quarters then, too, though, right? Yeah. It was all. It's always good. It's always good. But it's just a day of travel and 2 days of meetings, and I get home at like 10 o'clock. It's actually. Yes, but you got to go to Seattle first, and the last flight out of Coleman, which is the one you have to be on, is 7 o'clock at Coleman. You have to get home to like midnight. If you find an out of Spokane, you get home close to about 9 o'clock at night. So it's kind of worse. We always talk about killing time for the airport, so it's a bunch of us decided we're going to try to drive. So we're looking forward to it. But we'll see you at the first CSD. It's on my calendar.
I did the same thing, and I'm like, I'm not going to watch it then.
I will take you on a trip.
I'm like, he's going to get mad.
No confidence in coming back, it's not going to change again. Well, right, but you get my point, right? I mean, you worked your way under our understanding to figure out how to make your decisions on it. When I was in Ohio, the Washington Fair was July. I was actually at Common House Superintendent's meeting when they announced that the kindergarten the DeWalt kid was graduating from high school next week, and we were still enjoyed meeting.
We became adults.
I grew up in Alabama.
dance, it's better be earth-shattering.
This is going to be earth-shattering. We're going to hand me around.
No.
Let's see if this is working.
Okay, take it away.
So I'm going to deviate just in order in terms of what it says here. It says first ACES, then data, and then what we're doing. So I'm going to start with the data because public health folks usually start with data. So, and you guys may all know about this, and then I'll talk a little bit about some of the looking at what risk factors associated with some of these behavioral health issues, and then we'll talk a little about adverse childhood experiences. And I think you guys are already familiar with ACEs, right? You've heard a lot about it. So I didn't want to repeat that whole thing. So this is what I plan on just talking about here, and then hopefully we'll have time for talking about this. And I know suicide has been a big issue, so I thought I'd throw up some of the vital stats, their death records in terms of suicide as well. So we use death records, and then we have access to the Healthy Youth Survey, and as you know, it's a survey done on 6th, 8th, 10th, and 12th graders every 2 years in the state of Washington, and we have, and you probably know this already, that we have access to the Healthy Youth Survey as well as you do, and we can do analyses. It's a rich data set, and we can look at, I'm going to show you some cross-tabulations where we look at associations between different answers on the survey. Anybody have any questions about the Healthy Youth Survey? You're all familiar with it? I'll move on then. So this just gives you an idea of the suicide by age group, and it's a problem, certainly a tragedy in 10 to 19-year-olds, but as you can see here, they do not have the highest rate of suicide of the population. And this is the problem with suicide analysis is that, you know, the vital records aren't as quick, the death records in terms of doing the analysis and putting it together. But this gives you an idea of where we're going, and it looks like there's this tremendous increase from 2008 to 2013-15. And while there is an increase there, both in the state and in the in Clark County, I should point out that as tragic as each one of these are, the numbers are fairly small, so you can get variation from year to year. But we have seen somewhat of an increase over the last several years. And that's probably one of the things, one of the reasons we're all here together talking about this stuff. So I already mentioned what the Healthy Youth Survey is, and I'll show you some of the 2016 data. And you guys are all a big help for this because you encourage kids to participate. And we have a pretty good participation rate in Clark County. I think it's around 70%, which is darn good for a survey. And we're going to show you 10th graders' results because they have the largest participation. So just to give you an idea, actually, I'm going to show you others, 8th and 12th as well. So just going to just, you've probably already seen this. These are our marijuana use. You can see it goes up. But you can see that 25%, one out of four kids, by the time they're seniors, have used marijuana in the last 30 days. A smaller amount have been using e-cigarettes and vaping instruments. Still, it's about one out of five. We're a little bit lower than Washington State. Tobacco use has actually been dropping over the last number of years, so not that I'm excited that, you know, 11, one out of nine kids is smoking cigarettes, but it has dropped. We've really made good progress on that over the years. Yes.
It is, are those distinct from the students that are vaping, or could those be the same students?
I'm going to show you some cross-tabulations of kids who do a number of things, but I can tell you from cigarette use and drugs is that they all go together. So kids who smoke cigarettes are more likely to use other drugs. Kids who use, like, for example, marijuana are more likely to use other drugs as well. And I'm going to show, that's what's so great about the cross tabs. I'm going to show you an example of that in a minute. This is alcohol. I think it's amazing. Well, we've got close to a third of kids in the 12th grade who have used alcohol in the last 30 days. One in five in at 10th grade, 10th graders. We're close to what the state level is, but I think it's problematic whether or not we are. So here's what you're asking about. So
Of those who drank alcohol in the past 30 days, you can see that they also use more likely to use marijuana, smoke cigarettes. I showed you what the marijuana rate is. Here, 53% of those who drank are also using marijuana. You know, those kids use marijuana. And so these all go together. You asked about cigarettes and e-cigarettes. So those of you, you know, this whole notion that e-cigarettes are a way for kids to stop using combustible tobacco. But as you can see, kids who are using e-cigarettes, 36% of them also use conventional combustible cigarettes. Same thing, you know, you look at marijuana, they're more likely to use cigarettes, they're more likely to drink alcohol. And so these things, one of the benefits of having the Healthy Youth Survey is you can actually do all these cross-tabulations and see the association. So I think that probably answers your question about that. So then you can take a look, because the Healthy Youth Survey asked you for a variety of questions. We took some social determinants data here, and you can see that, for example, 6% of Clark County 10th graders experience housing insecurity. And I can get you the particular question that defines housing insecurity, and Andy, I don't know whether you know it or not, but we can get you the questions on the Healthy Youth Survey. But you can see those of housing insecurity. Also, close to half of them use alcohol, marijuana, or e-cigarettes. Poor family management, 1 out of 3, which is a concern. Those kids are more likely to use substances. Food insecurity is associated with substance use. And gang activity is associated with substance use as well in high levels. So the average for 10th graders is 27.5%, close, you know, more than a quarter use some sort of substance, but you can see those numbers are a lot higher if they have these other social determinants going on. Concerns, I find, you know, the numbers of completed suicide are fairly small, so they're difficult to look at trends with, but when you look at some of the behaviors or some of the Healthy Youth Survey questions that are associated with suicide, you can see that 10th graders in Clark County, 1 out of 5 have actually considered suicide. And I believe this is in the past year, and close to 9% have actually attempted suicide. And one of the benefits of the Healthy Youth Survey, if you guys are interested in some specific question about, for example, suicide ideation, what are the associated risk factors, we can actually generate numbers for you. And we can do this by school district as well as even by school if you are so interested. So then what's the tie-in with ACEs? And you guys all know what ACEs are, so I'm not going to belabor this one. Here are the factors, the ACE factors that relate to the ACE score, and you're all familiar with that. And these are in adults. As you can see, as the ACE score increases, you have a greater increase in risk for substance use, as well as chronic disease like heart disease, as well as suicide. So there's an association between ACEs and certainly in adults. And we're going to show you kids too with substance use disorder as well as suicide. And this is just a graphic that shows you there's a connection between all these things are interconnected. For 21% of Clark County 10th graders have been physically abused, which is one of the ACEs. And you can see, compared to the average of about 1/5, close to half of these kids are using some sort of substance. Similarly, the sexually abused kids, more likely to use substances. Emotionally abused, more than half of them are also using substances. Dating violence is associated with substance use. And even if they've witnessed physical abuse among adults, which is about 1 in 5, they're more likely to be using alcohol, marijuana, or e-cigarettes. So all these things, these are cross-tabulations that kind of show you the associations. I don't know whether this is new or not. I may be telling you stuff that you guys already know, but I thought these were kind of interesting. So here's some of the ACEs. If you've been physically abused, you're 2.6 times more likely to be using drugs. Sexual abuse, 3 times. Emotional abuse, 4 times. dating violence three times. If you just witness violence, more than three times more likely. Housing security 2.5 times, food insecurity 2x, and gang involvement. So all these factors on the left there are associated with risk for substance use. And these substance use put you more at risk for suicide, or at least suicide ideation. And I don't need to go through the numbers, but you can see that use of any of these drugs puts you more at risk of at least considering suicide. And we can get you, I'll be happy to get you the PowerPoint if you want these data. So, and then even attempts, you can see that that the substance use, each one of these things is more likely, you're more likely to attempt suicide. All this stuff is gleaned from the Healthy Youth Survey, and we can look at the trends over time as well. And this is a relationship between suicide ideation and ACEs. So ACE scores, the higher your ACE score, the more likelihood you are to consider suicide as well as attempting suicide. I found these pretty impressive. So there's a relationship between ACEs and substance use. There's a relationship between substance use and suicide ideations and attempt. And there's a relationship between ACEs and suicide ideation and attempt. They're all correlated with each other. So that's my little spiel. I wanted to give you guys have probably heard about ACEs and adult chronic disease, but I just wanted to share with you the impact of ACEs, a potential impact of ACEs in terms of what you're seeing in kids in your schools, and which is why we've been pushing for, you know, getting all of us a bit more trauma informed. So, and we're happy to have the ACEs Action Alliance come in, folks. Some of you are involved, but there is an ACEs Action Alliance in Clark County that are doing some great work here, and we can get you some more information on that. I did not bring them along, but you can get more information from emailing them. I have some of our folks here who might, I don't know, Janice, if you want to add anything or no. Okay. And this gives you some example of some of the work that's being done around ACEs. We're certainly training providers. They're certainly training providers looking at developing ACEs screens. Personally, I think that all healthcare providers, and when we talk about integrated behavioral health and physical health services, I'm a primary care provider by background. I think that primary care providers should be doing ACEs screen when they see, certainly when they see adolescents. Developing a referral resource list, and we'll be working with our partners on that around when kids are identified and they have these issues, how they can be referred. We've been working. I know we've done a lot of work in Battleground on doing ACEs training and doing trauma-informed training. We can do more of that. One of the things when you do become trauma-informed, and you guys have may have already done this in your school districts, is to change disciplinary policies, because the last thing you want to do with a kid who's got ACEs is re-traumatize them by disciplining them. It was always, it's always been amazing to me since I got the soapbox here around things like substance abuse. I consider it a chronic disease, and for other chronic diseases, when you get sicker, you actually get more help. With substance use, it seems sometimes that the sicker you get, the less help you get, or you get kicked out of programs. Same thing with discipline. The more you act out, which is part of your, you know, what your behavioral issues related to ACEs, instead of getting more services, you get re-traumatized. So hopefully people are working on changing the disciplinary policy so that, you know, we're trauma-informed and we're not repeating the trauma. And then on the side there, we're also working with our law enforcement folks related to that are getting certified in ACEs. There's a gang prevention task force and working with juvenile justice. So you can get more information from the ACEs Alliance. So that's some of the stuff that's been going on. We're happy to provide more data, more information, and hook folks up with ACEs training or whatever works. So I don't know if that's what folks wanted, but broaden. If there's any questions.
Any questions for Dr. Melnick or Vanessa?
Have you read the WSU white paper from like 2011-12 where they worked with the Spokane School District and they did an ACEs study and they correlated absenteeism, health problems, discipline referrals, and academics? You know, that's one of the things that I just shared with all of our staff this last week, is that a student with three or more, or with two ACEs, is four times more likely to have discipline issues than a student with no ACEs. And with three or more, they're six times more likely. So when you add those up, probably 60% of the discipline issues that we deal with as a system are kids with two or more ACEs.
Exactly.
And getting our staff to recognize the triggers and what's causing the behavior and deal with the cause of the behavior, not the behavior itself.
And when you're dealing with them, trying to avoid re-traumatizing these kids, because their brains already on high alert just from what they've mm-hmm. suffered before, and it's counterproductive to re-traumatize. I'm not an ACEs expert, but I know enough about it. And that's why it's great if we can help you any way and get your staff trauma-informed, that might help a bit.
Can you give me an example of a discipline that would traumatize someone like this, like something?
Well, the greatest discipline would probably be expelling somebody or suspending them or kicking them out of a room or
okay.
something like that. That would be an example. I mean, and also just the way we talk to these kids. And one of the first things you learn, again, I'm not an expert on this, but when you're interacting with the kid, instead of saying what's wrong with you, is what happened to you is a better response to a kid than saying what's wrong with you. Because, but
I get that, but at what cost? At what point do you think about the other kids in the school? I mean, how far
yeah.
are we going to go?
Yeah.
Who becomes the victim? At what point are we monitoring that? Is my concern the concern that I hear from the other parents that I deal with in my neighborhoods?
I think there's a balance to be found between. Look at it as there's a continuum here. It's not an either or, and kids have a plethora of experiences and varying degrees of need, and so do the kids who don't have a problem with that. So that's balancing this. I mean, I can think, and I won't go into all the details, but I mean, I can think of many, many examples of cases where, yeah, you're absolutely right. There's something that we could have done differently. I think about the things over time in my experience as a high school principal that I would have done differently. But I also know, too, that I've got to balance the needs of other kids. Conversely, there are students where they do put others at harm and at risk. And again, so that might warrant a different kind of response. So, and again, I don't want to get into the minutia of what those responses will be. I think it's as long as we have kids who have these problems, and we have, by the way, their parents and their adults in their lives who have these problems, the schools are going to have the problem. So we need to continue. We're never going to, like, we've got the total solution here, but we have to always be mindful of how do we best cope with that specific child's need today, and what might we need to do differently within the culture of that school environment or the system to handle them. And that changes. I mean, I think we're doing some things that are much better now than we did years ago. So I think more than anything, it's about having healthy conversations like this. It's about continuously elevating that level of awareness, and we do our best.
I completely agree with you. I mean, safety is number one. I mean, I think we all agree with that. We need to have a safe environment. But that being said, measures that are least restrictive or least traumatizing to get the same result. But I completely agree. It's not like, you know, one way or the other way. But being informed about this and finding the least restrictive way to get the safety, all the things being equal, I totally support that.
And I think often you get better results, not the same results. You get better results
mm-hmm.
from those kids rather than just your problem, get out, you know, when you deal with it and find out what's going on and do it in a way
behavior's impact on other people.
It's moving away from punishment and moving towards discipline, and true discipline is about teaching and learning, and you've got to take a look at the individual and not be a bureaucrat and say, we have this list of punishments we're going to dole out. You have to say, what has happened to this child, what happened in the situation that created this child to act out in this way, and then what is the best approach to get this student to learn what they've done is wrong, repair the harm to the student that they harmed, and re-enter with dignity back into the educational environment. And that's the approach that we're trying to take.
And teaching is spare time, right?
Well, yeah.
It is teaching.
I understand.
You know, the Evergreen Board tomorrow night is going to adopt new results policies that they're going to expect me to achieve with every student in our school district. And there's three components to the results. One is academic achievement, one is social-emotional learning, and the other is citizenship and civics. And those three components will define a well-rounded student in the Evergreen School District. That social-emotional part is what we're talking about. It's not every kid comes to us understanding how to behave in a classroom or in society. And if we just kick them out every time they misbehave instead of bringing them in and teaching them, we're doing a disservice to that student as well as our entire community once they exit our system.
One thing to think about is a lot of those kids we're talking about who might have gotten into a fight, I'm not generalizing to all of them, but if you look at the cross tabs, a higher proportion of those kids are going to have food insecurity, housing insecurity. They got a lot of other chaos going on in their life. I'm not justifying their behaviors.
No,
I'm just saying this is the kind of approach.
And we're not eliminating suspension and expulsions. We still have them, but they're for a much shorter time, and especially for our expulsions. Our reentry program, we get them right into it immediately, and it's based on restorative practices where we do restorative circles on a daily basis, and we start talking through what are those issues that led them to this point. And then we'll make a determination of, is their original school the best one to return them to, or do we need an alternative placement with a different high school that we want to, or middle school that we want to return them to give them a fresh start to be able to overcome some of the baggage that they've created for themselves. But that's sort of this whole restorative and trauma-informed care approach of what's best for the student and how do they repair the harm that they've done in teaching them that that's how you really restore things.
That's a really good point because this is multi-generational.
Yes.
So high A scores beget high A scores. And if we're ever going to interrupt this and get anywhere, we have to get to the source.
Right. And so one of the tools and one of the things that we'll learn from this pilot is if you use the ACE scores of a parent, we know that the predictive value of outcomes for the youth are going to be somewhat consistent. So then how do we actually take that and just take it out of the clinic setting and put it in a larger, broader that the old community can understand within the work that we do day to day, we have a lot of opportunities upstream because we know the challenges of these kids. And we can wrap an entire healthcare system around that and community supports around that. That's a real-life sort of example of what I'd like to continue to talk about as well.
I think there are multiple prongs to the solution here, multiple variables that affect it. And I think to the degree that we as a system, educational system, mental health system, public health, all of those components continue the press, if you will, we have to look at this type of cultural change from a generational perspective and a cultural perspective because, I mean, like I said, this is my 30th year. And I was, you know, I'm a superintendent, but I started as a high school teacher. Believe me, and I know it's hard to see sometimes, but we're in a different place now than we were 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Just if you look at mental health alone in terms of people's willingness to come to the table and get services for themselves or for their children, that's huge. So it takes time, and, you know, if we finally get there and I'm retired when that happens, then that's great. But it takes people's careers to see that level of change relative to a culture that accepts certain things, changes certain things, looks at restorative practices differently. We weren't having conversations around restorative practice 5 years ago. I mean, we were, but not to the degree we were. And the same thing could be said of mental health services. So you just can't let that leave the table, and we keep wrapping our arms around it. It's like I always tell my team, it's always going to get muddy. It's just a matter of how often you back away from it to really see clearly, clean yourself up, and then dive back in.
One of the advantages of this for me is it helps remove the stigma that's associated. Why people won't come forward around this stuff. But part of the cultural change is understanding the stuff and removing the stigma that's associated. Not that we'll get there in my lifetime, but I think we are making progress.
Going back to discipline, I just wanted to mention that I don't think any principal that I know ever wants to suspend or expel a student. It's that they're kind of pushed to, that's the choice they have. That's the only way they can solution it. Some years ago, I worked on a task force with the state where we were looking at gang issues, but we actually came back and looked at discipline and how it feeds the gang issues. And we discipline kids, we expel them, they're on the street, they gravitate to the gangs. And to all those other behaviors that were on your list. And we went to the legislature with a recommendation, and it all goes back to funding. Those kids that are being suspended and expelled, to give them what they need is very expensive. And we recommended actually that the legislature, if a student was long-term suspended or expelled, that the district would get enhanced funding for those kids because they need wraparound services. You know, I don't know if this is something that really a county can do, but we have the resources here, and really that's what those kids need. You just think you need to feed the resources to those kids rather than just kind of warehouse them someplace. So if it's an alternative school, they need a lot of resources.
So the numbers of the kids that you're talking about are probably much higher than the ones, because these are the Healthy Youth Survey is kids who are in school.
Right.
But we're either going to spend some money now or end up spending money keeping people in jail, besides wasting all those resources of people who could have been productive, is incredibly expensive. Somewhere down the line, it's expensive.
But as a county or an ESD, certainly it's easier to provide some sort of system for those most needy kids that have to be disciplined, rather than district by district, because I don't even know if Washougal has, you know, kind of, do you have enough kids to justify a program, but an ESD could.
Well, we partner with three different mental health service groups right now, and I sit on the board for with the children's center. So, I mean, from my perspective, having been in a large school district and now in a smaller school district, where we are in terms of driving mental health services and providing opportunities for mental health services in a community, much less now in the school, we're light years away. We're so far down the path from where we were 10 years ago. And you know what? Sometimes we always talk about, well, it's just not enough, it's not enough. And granted, it would be great to have more, but celebrate where we've come from, and then let's take another look at, so how do we, well, how might we do better? But we are doing better.
We are doing better.
And we can always do better. But we are doing better now than where we were. So I think, and again, part of my job, as you can tell here, is it's superintendent, but it's counselor with team to say it's easy amongst everything that we've talked about here to get really down on yourself about what we're not doing versus no, what are we doing really well, and step back from it, learn from it, and continue to connect with everybody here in the room or in the community. And they're good people doing great work.
Can I mention, too, to add on some of Dr. Melman's that you brought up, and sitting in threat assessment as a behavior person who comes to the table, some of the things, not only with ACEs, is kids who come to school tired. That's one of the number one things. They're not sleeping. How do you expect them to do? One of the things we've learned, too, living in the Northeast, the Pacific Northwest, are, you know, vitamin D levels.
I'm going to say one more thing. I'm selling the positive. No. I know that. But because, again, it's easy to look at the data and say, oh, man, we're just not doing enough. But if you look at the community schools model that has grown immensely here in the county in the last 10, again, in the last 10 years, there's a reason it has. It's connected to everything that we've talked about here today. Okay? We've wised up. We have. We've looked at how we can use resources differently. And every school district, I think, that sits at this table today has, to varying degrees, either family resource centers, family community centers. I mean, they may have their own take on it, but that exists to support kids and families and connect them to the resources. So you just got to keep doing.
Yeah, we have a great community. You know, it's showing the, you know, like the ACEs Action Alliance. There are a lot of positive things that are going on.
Sure.
I didn't mean to.
I was going to give you, I never thought that for a minute.
I want to give you a great segue because we can talk about what we're already doing in the schools, but I think one of the biggest challenges that, and I'll probably speak for every superintendent, one of the biggest challenges we have right now is these incoming kindergartners that I'm going to get 20 of them this year, and I don't know what schools they're going to show up to, but they're going to be tornadoes when they hit the classroom. There will be computers flying. There will be stuff ripped off the walls. I've had principals threatened that they're going to slit their throat with profanities, and these are five-year-olds that walk into the classroom the first 2 weeks of school, and I'm going to get phone calls from principals saying, I need at least two one-on-ones, I need two adults to be with this kid in order to keep this child in school, and how can we as a community start to really identify these two, three, and four-year-olds before they get to school age and start to work through the trauma those kids have already experienced and get them ready to be able to enter a school environment by the time they're 5 years old. So if that's something, and we're talking about future actions, that's a need that we have right now. And it's really a nationwide trend.
And there's no way that schools are going to solve all these.
Schools can't solve that. We need
and
the county's help to solve
that
it. Yeah.
Help you, but certainly this is a community problem, not a school problem.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm trying to segue into next steps.
Yeah. So one of our Actually, our primary intention as we were preparing for this meeting was to give you all an opportunity to understand what it is that the county does and our links to our, in these areas that you identified at the last meeting, our links to our community partners and some of the work that we're doing. So I think that I'm hoping that this meeting accomplished that. I'm hoping that we can now take 10 minutes to have a conversation about what that there was an additional issue that received a lot of votes that we could put on the table as potentially having at our next meeting, which is a countywide school emergency planning and preparation. And we could be helpful in coordinating that for you. I think it would be also be interesting and helpful for us to know if there's other information or steps that you would like us to take that would be appropriate for the county to take in terms of the issues that we discussed today.
And I would say there are a number of groups in the community, so whether it's the ACES Coalition, there's the New Crisis Collaborative that's being, where you've got all these stakeholders, nonprofit providers, payers coming to the table trying to address these systems. I feel like we need to build off of that because you've already got people trying to work on this to address some of this stuff here, especially with some of the new services coming around the youth. And I guess I would just figure out how can we tap you guys more into that if you're not already there, so you can, as they're developing and building the system and improving the system, because we are doing quite a bit right now, really good, but how do we make it better? We want to make sure that you guys are at the table.
And I think from kind of probably the board's perspective and maybe the other cities is, this makes impact fees for the growth plan almost fun. So the question is as schools, where do you see the relationship that you want the county to be at, assisting you or something? Where do we see that relationship going? And maybe it's getting below the 3, 4, and 5 year olds kids to really spend their time there or things like that.
Will help. Sometimes it's not necessarily going to help those kiddos, but at least if we're aware of them. But I was stunned that emotional abuse was a higher risk levels with emotional abuse than sexual abuse or physical abuse. And I bet there's lots of parents that, that's how my dad talked to me, and so that's how I'm going to talk to my kid, that have no idea about the impact that can, so educating our community, partnering with cities, educating the parents so that we can all be on a lookout for it and identify those kiddos and help them. I'm a high school counselor as well, and so often you don't know what's going on with these kids until they walk into your office in crisis, in high school when they didn't know how to ask for help.
So I think that your question, Councillor Bolt, is what is it that you need from us? How can we be of assistance? And how can this meeting, if we have it quarterly, how can it facilitate? Is it to facilitate a conversation? Is it to continue to build links between what you do and our departments and the work that they do? Is it to come up with ideas that we work together to find ways to implement?
I think one of the big values of today is hearing some of the resources in our community and knowing the needs and to be able to partner up. I kept hearing, you know, we need education at the table. Well, where are the tables and what, you know, specifically where are spots to plug in and, you know, put people in there, make sure that this group is represented and every district is represented, and so that we can continue this effort and spread it to everybody that needs. So have it. I think that's a great value, is bringing these resources together, having these conversations, and making sure there's a connection.
I think I'd echo that I'm trying to kind of process what you're asking and to see value out of this. If we came together quarterly and we picked one topic and we dug down fairly deep into that topic, sort of like what we just did with this, and an outcome of this to me is we as superintendents may agree that we're going to identify those kids, those kindergartners and first graders that come in this year, and we're going to say we knew we were going to get these kids because they were in our special ed preschool programs and we've been working with the families, but we had these six that came in just out of nowhere. Can we go back to the county and say, do you have any interaction with these families that would have given you a clue that we can start being much more predictive in the future instead of reactive? To me, that's a benefit that would come out of this type of an interaction, as one example of what we did today, and then we pick a different topic in the next quarter and a different topic in the next quarter.
Let me propose, because my department doesn't deliver direct services, but what I would propose based on what you just said, which is a concrete idea, is to do a data sharing agreement between the payers where you can share some data and they can try to wrap some services around those families. And then if there are initiatives that come out of the Accountable Community of Health that can also support that, that's where I start to see some links, because we need to somehow figure out who the people are. And not talk up here, but how do we...
And I know I jumped to an end solution, and there's about five steps or six steps that need to happen between this and that, but I'm just trying to give a model of how I see this meeting, this meeting on a regular basis benefiting the schools and the county.
And as far as those kindergarten students, it's almost like a child find system that we need for kids that are behavioral risks for school, because a lot of them will end up on behavioral IEPs by third grade. And if we could essentially figure out some way, the county might be bigger than that, it might be a state issue, that there's essentially a child find, you'd use ACEs scores to say, we need to get some services to these kids long before they get kindergarten.
You can intervene. I mean, folks are even talking about intervening during pregnancy and preconception. But the earlier you can intervene, the better the outcomes tend to be. So that's something we need to brainstorm about. And certainly, I agree with Vanessa, working with our healthcare providers, especially now that we've got integrated services and we can begin looking at behavioral issues that affect entire families. But the earlier we can intervene, the better.
I'm not sure how to insert myself in this conversation, but I will, just for the sake of this same conversation that I'm hearing today, I hear with groups of primary care doctors. So what I take away is, you know, how do I merge what you guys are suggesting in terms of early identification? These kindergartners, they went to a doctor sometime between 0 and 5. And so, you know, most likely. But they,
important, and you know, I come from a primary care background and I go for that, but we need to think about the social determinants, the housing issues as well. I don't want to.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
I'm sorry.
From Molina, our case management, very robust program, working with Judy and other specialists in my office, and we get referrals from all kinds of sources, whether it be the jail or the schools or whatever. And if we have a way to communicate and we know who those families are, we can help support them with the housing, with the doctor's appointments, with the behavioral health. So there's lots of opportunities to work.
So, Vanessa, I wonder, would it be appropriate for us to come back with some proposals for making those links for the next meeting?
I'll touch base with guys, we'll draft some stuff up to come back.
Okay. Okay.
Just real quick on South
Side.
So you have
so the list of issues. Remember the first meeting we all had a brainstorming and voted
on the issues. And we're going through the top five issues.
Mm-hmm.
So we've gone through permitting and we got some of the youth coping and county youth coping skills and supporting student success. What I propose is we meet in early November and we'll look at countywide school emergency planning prep and we'll organize the program.
Can I mention, I'm sorry, I know the grads program, that works with parenting teens, right?
Mm-hmm.
Grads program, that's
correct.
Something else to think about, services for them, because their kids are going to have ACEs for. So, and you guys are already doing that stuff. So I'm just thinking about early intervention. You know, we do the nurse family partnership as
mm-hmm.
well,
mm-hmm.
but certainly working with the teenage parents that you already have in your schools, thinking about their next generation that you're going to see as kindergartners in a few years. So something else, some other thing to think about, something that you're already doing.
And yes, I agree, Lori, what I would propose for the next meeting is that we do meet in early November and that we have a discussion on trying to create some appropriate links between providers and schools, but also to have this to engage CRESA and have a conversation, because you did want to have at the last meeting sort of a countywide at least planning overview for if there are emergencies in schools, one or more schools. So I think that we can plan to do that at the next meeting.
Okay, so great.
Last thoughts?
Hopefully we'll come back to this portable.
Yes.
We should figure something out, okay? That's always fun. And to complete one thing, so we'll work on that.
Yes,
and maybe, the other one is, Andy, who's going to start coming by this winter housing? How do we figure, because when I was in there, I was amazed how many kids are in who, and they're all going to school, and it's and I think it's a good discussion for this group to, how do we figure that combination out?
Winter
it's
housing,
yeah.
And winter housing for students.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then also, I don't think it's probably this time, but we impact fees. It's always an exciting thing. Gives you all a chance to collectively be mad at the council, so it brings people together. You can shake your head, Mark. I'm just bringing it up sooner because I think, first of all, there's five of us that kind of figure it out. Also, more city council people need to figure out. And also, my phone is just ringing off the hook of me trying to explain McCleary at the same time trying to figure impact fees, and I don't have a thing to tell them. Marnie, I think we should really get on this because we're going to start getting calls. So let's have the same thing to say.
Yeah, school funding in itself is a probably a workshop conversation.
Yeah, it is.
because it goes back many, many, many years, and just
yeah.
the Cleary issue itself goes back a decade. So, yeah, I don't know if I could tackle that one. Although I think we have information that would be helpful to you.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of where do we do that?
I think the key is that the council is saying the same thing you're saying, so the people aren't getting different things.
Well, and again, to the degree that we have to perhaps come together in a subcommittee meeting to identify, so what is the executive summary to where we can help the council or help others understand that issue without getting into the details of it, although it's hard. It's an easy trail to all of a sudden follow a particular path with. I think I agree that's important. I was looking at this list here, and I think I like to think about systems and process, and I think I look at this, and I look at, we've talked about permitting, but also down underneath that, I look at a number of other of these really around school construction and growth, which then does put impact fees in there. It's kind of a big bucket area. Additionally, supporting student success is a big bucket area, but I'd probably lump into that youth coping skills, right? So, I mean, we could fold a number of these in here versus looking so broadly at this list and think we have to tackle all of them, because I would argue for our health and success as a team going forward, we'd be better off with three, or maybe that's the max area, three with key areas, but then with subcommittee work or what like we did on Friday, I think long term it's going to be more manageable in terms of we're trying to come back to this as a group.
Yeah.
I think the initial idea was that we look at the top five, and so that's why we looked at permitting and youth coping and county, and then coming up countywide emergency planning and then student success. And that was the
But I think if there are timely issues, like in November will be an appropriate time to talk about winter housing for students who struggle with homelessness. I mean, it's a timely issue for us to discuss at the beginning of November.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank
Thanks
you.
For coming.